Today's sponsor is the monkey from Neon and Atomic Monster. If you have your shit together, then you've already seen this movie. It did come out this past weekend, and it had a great opening weekend, made a ton of money. But sometimes life gets in the way. I totally understand that. If that happened to you, I highly encourage you to catch the flick before it leaves theaters. This is an audience movie, and you need to see it with a crowd of unsuspecting folks who have no idea how gory and fun and hilarious this movie can get. Based on Stephen King's iconic short story, The Monkey has been brought to the screen by Osgood Perkins, who just so happens to be today's guest. Prepare yourselves. You're going to hear a lot about The Monkey from Oz over the next hour. You know him. He's the writer-director of Longlegs. He made this movie with the help of horror master James Wan. Stephen King himself described the film as, quote, batshit insane, and said, "You've never seen anything like it." And Bloody Disgusting calls it the most outrageous horror movie of the year. And Eric Vespi of the KingCast says, "This movie rules. Go see it." They didn't tell me to put that part in, but I'm, you know, throwing in a little extra spice for you. I've seen it. I love it. I think everybody needs to watch it so we can all talk about it and celebrate just how fun this movie is. The Monkey is in theaters now. Go see it. And we have to talk about Fangoria. Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible. And it's delivered right to your front door 4 times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. Little note, in this next issue, you're going to get some last words from Pop-Pop. Mr. Wampler had a little bit of a Life of Chuck set visit that I helped kind of bring home. He left that for us, and so we're going to get a little bit of Vespi and Wampler in this next issue. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you're going to need to subscribe. So in order to do that, just head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And if you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save a massive 25% off of your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bedlam! Bedlam!
Anybody's gonna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
And I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are your hosts. It's been The Monkey all the time, every day here around these parts lately, and that's for good reason. This movie fucking rules, and it's kicking off what looks to be like a banner year for Stephen King adaptations. Mm-hmm. The cast is great. The kills are out of this world. The balance of humor and horror is just what you want, and it's mostly thanks to today's guest. He's a writer, director, and actor, and you don't need me to list off all of his credits leading up to The Monkey, so let's just cut to the chase and welcome Osgood Perkins to the KingCast. Welcome to the show.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for having me. What a pleasure and a privilege.
We normally ask new guests to the show what their Stephen King origin story is, and that's a, kind of an icebreaker, like, around these parts. And I think that, like, the, you know, it doesn't have to be like, oh, I read Cujo when I was 5 or whatever. It literally could be I saw a cover for a book on a shelf. I saw a movie, you know, that was my intro into Stephen King, as I was a movie kid and I saw some adaptations first, and that's what led me to the book. So but it's always really interesting to me to find out, like, what's the thing that kind of put Stephen King on your radar?
Well, for me, it was I guess New York City, probably 1979 or so. Maybe I'm muffing these dates a little bit, but that's not my memory anyway. And my parents are out at some fabulous thing, being fabulous people that they were. And I am at home with my babysitter. It's the middle of the night, and I wake up to go downstairs to get a drink of water or whatever it is. And she's watching Salem's Lot. And I happen to walk in right as the vampire kid is floating outside the window. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, that's no good. but I should probably stick around and watch more. So right. I think I sort of sat with her, watched more of the movie than I probably should have. But that was enough. The floating kid out the window was more than enough for me. She sends me back up to bed. I get into bed and I had one of those car beds, those beds that were sort of fiberglass shaped like a race car.
Ooh.
And I was falling asleep and my hand, I had left my hand out over the side of the bed. And I so clearly remember thinking I should really pull my hand in so that when my parents come home and come to say goodnight to me, they don't think I'm dead.
Oh,
Yeah, so that
yeah.
was that.
Okay,
That's me.
that see, I was
That.
thinking you were going to go a different way with that, and that's the, of course, you have to pull the hand in because that's the monsters will get you if you
That's
don't.
how they
No,
get you.
I
Yeah.
didn't
want my folks to think that I had, been that any vampires had come to my window and sort of changed me.
That.
What's the famous painting from the of the person who's dead and lying in the bathtub with their arm
The
draped
bathtub,
out,
the
right?
death of whoever, the death of
Yeah.
somebody. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see
That.
that.
That's what
That
it.
image of the kid floating outside the window is so indelible. I coincidentally just did a story about this, well, like maybe 2 years ago. At Halloween at Vanity Fair, we always try to do a little like horror themed story, and I tracked down the kids who played those parts, and they talked about how fun it was, kind of floating around on the crane and being swept in and shooting it in reverse. If you watch that again, the steam and smoke
Yeah,
is
not
flowing
fun to
out,
see.
so it
Yeah, that's
creates this.
probably what did it. That's probably what did it. The backwards smoke. Oh, I hate it even more now that I think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then they play it in reverse, but
Right.
it has that sort of unreal quality. But they've never, I don't think they've quite topped that. They've done some other Salem's Lot adaptations,
Yeah.
but that window scene is kind of the terrifying Peter Pan moment that's
Yeah,
endured.
it is. Evil Peter Pan. But it also kind of goes to show what bringing a filmmaker like Tobe Hooper into this thing, because for like 80% of Salem's Lot, it is kind of a. I don't know. I don't want to diminish it. But it feels like a TV movie of its era, right? It's kind of flatly shot. They're getting their stuff. It's got some really cool performances in it. But then you get those moments where you can tell, like, I don't know. At least for me, I feel like Tobe Hooper is sitting there going, "Ooh, I'm gonna get him on this one." I got this. I got this. This moment.
He's like he's like he came he like came to work sober one day and was like, I'm gonna totally nail this day. This is gonna be my big day.
Yeah, only drinking Dr. Pepper. N nothing else. Nothing else going in the body today.
Oz, were you exposed to a lot of horror as a kid? You kind of sounds like that was like a coincidental thing, watching the over the shoulder of your babysitter. But you
Yeah.
know, your father was Anthony Perkins. Obviously, Psycho is a touchstone horror film. Your mom was Benny Berenson. Did they show you scary movies? Did you kind of grow up watching that, or was it something you came to
God, could
when
you
as a
imagine?
teenager?
Could you imagine how reprobate they would have been? It's time. It's time to come and sit and watch. It's Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Happy birthday. Happy seventh birthday. Your present is you get to see Cannibal Holocaust. No, I mean, like, there was some incidental stuff. Like, my dad used to get things, back in the days of mail, he used to get mailed things on occasion. Like, it was certainly Fangoria magazine definitely would send sort of the weekly, monthly, I guess monthly issue, and would get that. And I got my hands on a copy of Fangoria when I was probably about 7 or 8 or so in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, where we had our summer house. And I got the magazine and I flipped through it, and then it became absolutely vital to me that I cut out the picture of Linda Blair as Reagan with all of her lesions on her face. I had to take that picture, cut it out of the magazine, and put it at the very bottom of my toy chest. And I had to know that it was there. Like, it became this like fixation for me. I was like, as long as it's sort of there, I know where it is. I can look at it when I want to look at it. I cannot look at it when I don't want to look at it. But that it's funny, that sort of memory resurfaced as a bit in Long Legs, right? When she goes into her toy box and finds the Polaroid of him, was sort of taken from that real life beat. So we had stuff kind of casually lying around. One of my prized possessions now is a fan sent my dad a beautiful Sharon Tate signed headshot.
Wow.
Just wow.
and it's just like I guess he needed my dad to have it more than he needed to have it. So I still have that. It's a beautiful relic of times gone by. But yeah, there's stuff kind of around, but no, there was no kind of indoctrination or kind of baptism into the horror world that was happening with my folks. They were fairly normal as parents.
Well, I
But
think there's.
sometimes, oh,
Oh,
go
go ahead,
ahead, Derek.
Anthony. Sorry.
Well, I was going to say sometimes, if you grow up in the store, as they say, you're kind of like, oh yeah, scary movies aren't really a thing. I know because, I know actors from scary movies. People are my mom and dad's friends.
Yeah, we were certainly the house where there weren't any rules, right? We're definitely like sort of like the druggy Hollywood, the fabulous druggy Hollywood house where we would invite our kind of friends from elementary school and have big sleepovers, and in goes a movie. And the movie that went in was kind of whatever we wanted it to be. So we definitely exposed kids. We didn't know what we were doing. Like, oh, Toxic Avenger, that sounds like that's funny. And we sort of show that to kids before they wanted to see it. Chud, cannibalistic humanoid underground dwellers, and all these sort of offbeat things. So there's permissiveness, but no baptism.
Well,
Isn't
there
that
I think
real? Oh, sorry. Now you
I was gonna say, I
go.
think there's a value in being a kid and finding that stuff yourself, though. I was kind of raised in a similar thing. My parents liked horror movies, but they weren't like, I want to sit you down and watch this horror movie with you. It was just, it was permissive. Like, if you were curious about it, you could watch it. And so, I found The Fly by myself. I found John Carpenter's The Thing by myself. I was finding all these movies, and I grew up in the age of Freddy Krueger and Jason Voorhees, so slashers were kind of the things that were like, oh, that's not really, that's not a real movie, that's just, trash or whatever, but they still were okay with me watching it. And I don't know, there when you find it yourself versus having somebody go, you need to like this or need to watch this, I think that maybe that leads to a moment like, I'm going to cut out Linda Blair's face and put it at the bottom of my
I
toy box.
must. It's not that I'm going to, it's I'm compelled to. I have to.
The power of Christ compels you.
Right from the magazine, yeah.
I was just going to say the same thing, Eric, is that there's this it sounds like what you've described there, Oz, is like you're asserting a little bit of control over something that's obviously terrifying. You grab it, you've cut it out, you've contained it, and now you can visit it when you want to. And I think that's what kids do with horror. That's how they get into it for the most part. Nobody or very few people just dive headfirst in. They kind of circle it like a cat, test it, try it out for size. I think so many people have that experience with King's work is they saw the cover of Carrie with the blood and they were too scared to look at it or watch that movie, but it intrigues them. And so as they get stronger, as they get more confident, as they get older, then maybe I'll watch that. Maybe I'll watch The Shining. And oh shit, that was a bad decision. It scared me,
Proverbial toe dip, right? Like you said,
Yeah.
like for me, and for me, that was the Pet Sematary paperback cover with the miswritten, the misspelled title written in the children's scrawl with the cat's face, with the big cat face on it, was for me, there was such an allure to it. It seemed like, oh, but it's misspelled. Oh, but it's children's writing. Oh, but it's fun. Is it fun? It seems like it could possibly be enjoyable. And when you think about King, and you think about like, oh, he's kind of the guy who said horror stuff is for fun. Like horror stuff is there to kind of please you. It certainly as an author, it seems like he's the guy to like, Edgar Allan Poe wasn't thinking that, right? You're gonna love this. It's gonna be a blast, right? You're really gonna chuckle at this, right? And he was just trying to make it through the day. But I think that King sort of invites you to sort of smile along with him as all this madness is happening, and to kind of grin a little bit. And there's this almost sort of Carnival Barker quality. I mean, I guess Bradbury has that too in Something Wicked This Way Comes, this quality of like, this is good. It's for kind of for kids, and it's sort of fun. It's sort of entertaining. That to me feels like part of King's sort of significant legacy.
Yeah,
Did I
okay.
read an interview where you said your father was reading Pet Sematary and that's where you saw it?
It was my dad's paperback. My dad used to read. I mean, it was like he was very anti-television, and so it was always paperback books with him. He traveled a lot, and there was a lot of planes and things. So, paperback books. And then when Misery came out as a hardcover, I was just old enough to read it alongside him. So he would read a chapter, I would read the same chapter. He would read a second chapter, I would read a second chapter, and that was definitely a bonding thing. And I loved that book, so much fun. And then the movie, of course. I just saw that they played the trailer of Misery in front of a screening of The Monkey a couple nights ago, and you, saw the trailer again. It's so funny how trailers used to be. They're just like so innocent almost.
What a cool thing to share with your dad,
Yeah.
though, is passing the book back and forth, and then you could talk about the story as it progresses. It's like
Yeah,
watching a movie
and
together.
it's like watching a movie together. It's like people who now have like a long distance relationships are like, we watch movies together online. Like we FaceTime each other and watch movies. I'm like, yeah, it's about the same thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have it right in that King does have this gleeful come along and play, and like Pet Sematary is one of his darker
Oh,
stories.
it's horrible. Reading it as a parent, it's absolutely, it's miserable,
And
horrible.
I mean, to the point where, the legend around it, and I think this is like 90% true, but the legend around it is that he didn't want to publish it. And he ultimately only did it because he owed a book to his publisher and wanted to get out of that contract.
Yeah.
And all that part's true, but I think he maybe oversells a little bit of the, oh, I just, I, it would, it was too bad, even or scary, even for me. I think he oversells that just a little bit, but I think it does have him confronting some really dark things. But even in that book, there is a playfulness, with Pascal showing up, with his brains hanging out, talking to the lead, trying to warn him away from this stuff. And that kind of leads us a little bit into the monkey. And I think the people who adapt King, they understand his humor as much as his horror. And I think that the reason why I love the monkey so much is that you do find that balance. Matter of fact, it is way more in kind of a Creepshow. I got a Creepshow poster back there.
I noticed.
Creepshow, vibe where it really is like, you and us are going to have some fun. We're going to watch some gore, and there's going to be some stuff that grounds it. The character work is going to be there. So it's not just going to be all surface level, but you want us to come in and have a good time with this movie. And there, you make no bones about it. And I love the marketing that Neon's done with it. I think it really sells that in a way. You talked about the trailer for Misery. Like, the horror trailers these days are just so algorithmically, set, and like it's so great to see something with personality, and I think
Let
that's
the
why
good
people
times
are,
roll. I love
yeah,
that
I think
addition
that's
to
why
the
people are looking forward
song.
to it, so.
Yeah, when I was given the privilege of adapting it, it came from James Wan and his producer Michael Clear and their partner at the time, Peter Safran, and they had they owned the rights to the story, and they had a script that was existing, and they sort of said, read these things, and we don't think it's quite right, and we'd love to get your kind of offbeat take on it. They were fans of The Black Coat's Daughter, and they kind of wanted something a little fresher than what they had. And I read the script, and the script was so kind of maudlin. And I was like, "What? I was like, it's a toy monkey. Like, how could this be in any way sort of serious?" The monkey's face, the presence of the monkey, kind of demands a playfulness. It demands this level of creep showness. Creepshow was the gateway for me tonally to get into this. It was the thing that felt the best, and it did have that kind of come along, let's do this together, let's see this weird gross stuff together. The narration plays to that, sort of the invitation of like, this is my life, this is me as a kid, this is how my life was, this is me now. The sort of almost the talking to the audience thing was deliberate in that way. And so in reading their very serious script and then reading the short story, and also just like I said, feeling much more in step with the Creepshow sort of tonality, I closed the script and I called them and said, "Well, I'll never look at this. I promise you, I'll never look at that script again. Can I start over?" They said, "We wish you would. We agree, it doesn't work." And I said, "And it's a comedy." And there was kind of a moment where they were like, "Oh." And they said, and they said, and I said, "Well, I think it's this and this and this and this." And they were like, "Okay, great. Well, go for it." And one of the delights of this movie has been that the sort of left, way left of center sentiment or sort of approach to this movie has been so supported by mainstream cinema sort of practitioners, right? Sort of mainstream producers felt like this was viable, and the support that they showed me around that was, I wasn't expecting it. And when I got it, it was great. And the idea was to revere King, to kind of make one for him. And I felt like it's kind of like, I said this in another interview today, it's kind of like I wanted to make a movie that I thought King would be kind of like, "Oh yeah, really? Cool." Like, I didn't see that exact thing coming. I think about, and I said this, in I think about like the Joker movie, which I like, needless to say, like you respect its success, you respect its impact, best actor award, all that. Like, I couldn't stand it. For me, I couldn't stand it because it was like the Joker would hate this movie. It would be like, what? Where's the jokes? Like, where's the fun? Where's the sick humor? Like, where's the fact that none of it's serious at all? And you're watching this super like over dramatic movie about the Joker, and I was just like, no, I think that's I is like I don't get that. So it was the same thing with this. It was like, I think King would really dig it if I just went bonkers on his thing and just like made a kind of a big surreal joke out of it. I think he would kind of get it, and he did.
I think we have to share his tweet or thread about it from 125, January 25th. You've never seen anything like The Monkey. It's batshit insane. As someone who has indulged in batshittery from time to time, I say that with admiration. That's a pull quote.
I mean, and that's everything, and that's mission accomplished, right? Like, if the movie does business, amazing. I think it'll do fine. People like it, they seem to like it. Like, audiences seem to really get into it. But for him to kind of feel seen, it was the idea. You know, like, not that he needs to feel seen, but I did
Some
want
finally,
I
yeah, somebody's paying
finally some
attention to Stephen
recognition
King.
if they made a decent movie out of one of my books. But to salute the guy was the intention, rather than to salute the genre or myself or anything else, but to salute the guy.
You brought up Creepshow, Eric, but also the tone of The Monkey and Creepshow matches his opening sequence in one of your favorites, Maximum Overdrive.
All
You
right.
know, the minute you send a minute you send that steamroller, Dukes of Hazzarding, into the baseball diamond to roll over the Little League team, I feel like you're in monkey territory there.
You
You're
have the
absolutely
bank telling Stephen King himself to fuck off, and
monkey.
No, it's and well, and I think that plays into tone and something that I'm curious about. This might be an overly serious craft question, so feel free to tell me to fuck off with a question like this,
Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait. Go for
but
it.
tone is an intangible, right? This isn't something that like it's a result of all the other pieces, right? But something in your work that you deliver on time and time again is a perfect tone for what you're making. Now, is this something that you kind of have to build brick by brick, or do you settle on this process of do you settle on the tone early and kind of use it as a guideline, I guess, is the other side. Like, I'm so curious how that works.
I'm curious as to how it works too. It's like I get, as you can imagine, asked a lot about sort of how do you do it? Like what's the keystroke that does the thing? And my best kind of answer is I've found the more that I do it, the less hard I try, the better it comes out, right? It's like watering your garden with a hose. And if you're fucking squeezing the shit out of that hose, water the fucking plants. If you're squeezing the hose, no water comes out, nothing grows. If you find a way to kind of go limp and just let the hose do the thing, the garden grows, as it were. Sorry to sound so cheesy, but you get my meaning. And so I find that relaxing into what you're doing is the only way to do it when it comes to facing the blinking cursor on the screen and the white page and the task of adapting something or generating something. You have to allow it to happen. And the only way that you can sort of prep that eventuality is to be honest about your intention and to be connected to to what you're doing, right? To know, to feel some authority, some authorship. And authority only can come for me from this is about me, right? This is about something about me that's real. This is about something about me that I know to be true, or wonder if it's true. This is something that has happened to me. This is something that I'm afraid of. This is something that I'm content with. This is something that I think is funny. This is something that I think is pop. Long Legs, which I wrote after The Monkey, I wrote The Monkey before I wrote Long Legs, was just sort of just like, I wonder if I could just make kind of a pop art piece on serial killer movies in the 90s. Like, I love those movies. They impacted me when I was 16, 17, kind of in that realm. And I was just starting to think about movies and how they get made and all this. And all of a sudden, there's these Seven and Silence of the Lambs, like these masterpieces. And I was kind of just like, well, I wonder if I could just do like a pop version of that. And so once I connected to that, it became, quote, easy, right? Like I knew my intention, and then I tried my best to relax. You show up every day at the computer, you clock in, you clock out. The Stephen King thing, right? Like you go in every day. If it's a good day, it's a good day. Great, good for you. If it's a bad day, it's a bad day. Too bad. Come back tomorrow. Try again. And so with the monkey, I felt like I was an authority on the material just because I had experienced, and we talked about this, Anthony, I'd experienced some rather shocking shit in my life, some really unexpected twists, right? Oh, this person's alive, this person's dead. Oh, this person's this thing, oh, this person's this other thing in a moment. And so I was like, oh, if that's what the monkey's about, I know more about that than anybody I know. Right? It's not so crazy. It's like, oh, people die in insane ways for almost no reason. Oh, right. Oh, right. Like it did with me. So then you put then authority takes over and your own sort of natural spirit takes over and you take your hands off the wheel a little bit and you let it happen. I know it sounds goofy, but it's the only way I know how to describe it. Once I connected to the fact that I knew more about the monkey than anybody on earth, it was like downhill skiing at that point.
We did talk about that in a Q&A I just ran in Vanity Fair. It's called Osgood Perkins Toys with Death in the Monkey. And I like what you said, Oz, about whenever writing something is such a lonely process. Your quote was something like, "You've got to make friends with the thing." And I thought, like, again, it's sort of like approaching a wild animal. Like you've got to like sort of like look it in the eyes and bow to it, but also assert some dominance and find your personal connection. And you talked about these losses you've had that really, would turn anyone's head around. And I think King also did this with his short story, which does have a different tone. It's not as wild as your adaptation, even though you captured the wildness that he has in other things. But the whole element of finding this monkey in his father's closet with his brother, raised by a single mom. The father in the short story is in the Merchant Marine. Steve's real dad was in the Merchant Marine and before he had kids, and then he abandoned the family. And so the monkey represented this notion that anybody could disappear at any time. And even though your experience with your mother and father and their awful, terrible, tragic deaths is very unique, to say the least, I do think most people know what it's like to lose somebody suddenly, to lose somebody unexpectedly when you thought there was more time. And that's a real thing underneath the surface of the monkey too. The monkey deals with it with humor, which is a good tool for grappling with it, but there's something kind of common there too, right? About
Oh,
the
absolutely. I
lightning
mean,
fast way somebody can vanish from your life. And in these cases, it's just
absolutely.
extremely gruesome.
It's extremely gruesome and it's treated with care, right? And it's treated with like the spoonful of sugar, right? Because like if I'd made the movie when I was 30, it'd be a real bummer of a movie. Like it'd be a really difficult, long, dark, mopey, maudlin, broken movie. And maybe that would have been fine. That would have been something else. That would have been a different kind of movie. Probably wouldn't have opened on 3,200 screens. Do you know what I mean? So in this case, it's like, yeah, there's the grief around what's happened, which is now contained, right? Grief when you're first in it, it's like this big spill, right? It's like this thing is like, there's no way out of this thing, and it's on everything and everywhere. Everything I touch now has like a little bit of shit on it, right? It's like it's just such a mess. And then as time goes on, you kind of organize yourself and you have new experiences, new people, new things. You change, you age, you have children, there's new things get reflected, you find new surfaces to see your reflection and blah blah blah. And the thing becomes this manageable entity. And it was, it's in the sense that all timing is perfect, right? It's like I got the opportunity to explore this stuff when I was already okay. Do you know what I mean? Like some people are like, did you use it? Has this movie been cathartic or healing for you? I was like, man, if I was walking into this movie with like a bunch of open sores, like I'm just bleeding out, let's make a movie. I don't think we would have made our days. Do you know what I mean? But as it is, I'm kind of like, I get it. It's a thing. It was really, really pretty awful, but it's kind of okay now. That was 25 years ago. Like it's not great, but it's kind of okay. Like I make peace. And so then you can sort of approach it however you want. And in this case, it just felt kind of nicer, kind of kinder to present it as a comedy.
I love in our conversation, I had to laugh when I read the transcript, and I think I asked you some variation on that, and you're like, yeah, there never was a day when I was like, wow, I'm really healing today.
And cut. I feel better.
Yeah,
You know what I mean? Like that's
that's more like it.
You've gotten a lot of monkey talk on the show. You're deep in the middle of it. I'm interrupting monkey talk to tell you, yes, you're going to get a little bit more monkey talk because today's sponsor, as I mentioned at the top of the show, is Neon and Atomic Monsters, the monkey. I'm very thankful that Neon and Atomic Monsters sponsored the show and have helped deliver two, dare I say, quality episodes of the KingCast. It also helps a lot that I love this movie. I've seen it twice now. And on my second viewing, what did I do? Well, I brought Mama Vespi, of course, and I think she loved it even more than I did. So, confirmed, moms love The Monkey. Based on Stephen King's iconic short story, The Monkey has been brought to the screen by Osgood Perkins, the writer-director of Longlegs, and the man who you've been listening to for the last 30 minutes, and horror master James Wan. Stephen King himself has described The Monkey as batshit insane and said you've never seen anything like it, and Bloody Disgusting calls it the most outrageous horror movie of the year. The Monkey is out in theaters now. Go see it and bring all your friends. And moms. Bring some moms too. Now let's get back to more monkey chat with the one and only Osgood Perkins. I started the show with a guy named Scott Wampler who passed away suddenly, you know, last year. And Anthony is stepped in as my new permanent co-host, and I'm very excited to, you know, he's been killing it so far, and we're gonna hopefully keep that trend rolling. But you know, he was the first person.
If something happens to me, please send the FBI to Eric's house. His co-hosts are.
I have a rock solid alibis. I don't even know when, but I just know I'm preparing for it. But you know, that was the first person in my life who I did where, you know, I went to sleep. Like I responded to him in an email that morning. I went and took a, like, you know, whatever we were going to record was pushed. So I went back to bed, and then I woke up a few hours later from a phone call from his roommate going, Scott's gone. And that was the first time I experienced anything remotely like that. I'm, you know, I'm lucky to, you know, still have my mom, and I never knew my, kind of like Stephen King, I never knew my biological father. So it's like, you know, anybody who's really close to me, you know, I've somehow dodged all that. But, you know, it's so interesting in dealing with that absence. And he was a chaotic figure. He was a very funny guy. He was a very sloppy guy in a lot of ways. And it just felt appropriate to, you know, to mourn him with humor and chaos, which is what he represented, sure. Which is why I know he was looking forward to this movie, and I know he would have loved the shit out of it. This is so up Scott's alley. But, you know, it's so funny you talk about, you didn't make this movie, you know, oh, I wasn't healing myself doing it. But, you know, there I felt some comfort watching it in my very unique situation, obviously, of going like, yes, it was like a warm hug to me, because this is exactly how, you know, the kind of tone that Scott and all of his friends reacted to his death with.
And that's the best news of all, right?
Yeah.
The news that I'm able to sort of it's like in the AA program, right? It's like you share your experience, strength, and hope, right? It's like I had a bad experience. I got sort of stronger about it. Things look a little bit better today, and so I can sort of share a glimpse. And if it works in any way medicinally for anybody, man, what a joy! Does Terrifier work medicinally for people? Maybe. Maybe, yeah. Maybe, maybe,
yeah.
Maybe, by the way, maybe there's like an EMT guy out there who's like, finally, someone shows me something that's worse than what I saw today. Do you know what I mean? Maybe that's like, thanks for that.
Maybe. It could always be worse. Yeah.
It could sure. always be worse. And it looks, oh, that's that. Mm-hmm. So, but that's great to hear. I mean, that's, you know, not to be, you know, kind of, you know, soft or kind of mushy about it, but like, what a great way for kind of art to work. Do you know what I mean? With some kind of healing impact, or some kind of just if it resonates, right? Whatever it is. And maybe Terrifier does resonate with people. It must. I mean, I love that shit.
I think it at least resonates as a form of distraction and escapism from you know, their day-to-day
news?
Worries. Yeah, yeah. To literally every moment of every day for the last few weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say like I watched it and was just like, oh, I've now been able to move on from this moment. But I think what it made me do is it made me feel justified in how I handled my own grief in that moment. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just like, oh
Shakespeare.
no, I did it right, because this is, you know, there's just something in this where again, I was watching it going, Scott would have loved this, and it wasn't a thought that made me sad. You know what I mean?
Beautiful.
So,
Beautiful.
I don't know. I don't know how I'm not a therapist, and you're not my therapist, so I don't know if you can deconstruct that for me. So
Well,
I
I'm your
won't ask you
therapist
for
now. I've actually become your
it. Oh,
therapist
good.
the last few moments.
Good. I
I
hope you
better
don't
be.
charge much, because I'm I'm pretty poor. But
I'm very expensive now.
yeah. Okay, good. Well, we'll you know, I'll have to pay in installments, but
Fair
we'll get
enough.
it through. So do you think that I have a favorite death scene in this movie, and I would wager that if you asked 10 people what their favorite set piece of the movie is, you might get 10 different answers. So do you think that that says a lot about the person who is watching the movie, if they react to, say, a disembowelment or the long, you know, setup punchline of you know, the fish hooks that turns into the fire that turns into the, you know,
For sale
the
sign,
sign,
yeah, turns
right?
into the
Like,
for sale sign pretty hard, doesn't it? Yeah,
yeah. So like, do you think that the set pieces, the way people respond to them, might be a way into their psyche? That's my question to you.
that's funny. I like from like a Rorschach test of splatter gore. I suppose that I mean it could very well be like it never occurred to me. Like it's you know I at a certain point there's a maybe always, maybe not at a certain point, but always there's like a tunnel vision with the creative process a little bit where you're like, I'm doing this thing and I gotta focus on what I'm doing. And then all these wonderful offshoots happen, especially in the world of making a movie where so many people are contributing, right? Everybody's artistry is on display. I'm just kind of curating the show. And so whenever someone has kind of an additional take or feel something unintended or notice something that I totally didn't mean. It's the best. It's the best. It's like, oh, this thing lives on its own. Oh, this thing has its own wants and desires, its own purpose. And I just kind of shepherd it through its birth, right? Like I'm kind of like the midwife. People say that, I guess, right? You're like, ah, I just kind of found the way to bring it into the world and then I let it go. And so that part's gratifying. I guess it could become kind of like that question you ask people like, oh, if you could have a superpower, what
Right.
superpower would you have? And people are like, oh, I would fly. And you're like, well, that person's confident. Oh, I would want invisible. Well, that person's a pervert, right?
Right.
So it's like, and it's funny because like I totally would take invisibility over flight, on flight. Like invisibility sounds really good to me. So I'll have to check that out. I'll have to check that out and see how people feel about do you want to be blown up or do you want to eat a bunch of hornets?
The hibachi kill is the one that it happened so early on, and I was just like, maybe it's just because it set the tone for me,
Yeah.
and I was just like, because it's not just that the kill happens or the unexpected death happens, it is it you put an exclamation point on the end of it. It's not just that the poor person loses their head. The head then falls into the food and grills on the grill. You know what I mean? It's like, I think at that point where I was like, okay, I know what this movie is, maybe. And that's when I'm like, and I'm really excited. And I mean, I'm saying this, your cold open to the movie, it tells you exactly what the movie is too. But you know, I don't know, but it was, for whatever reason, it was the hibachi one for me that I was just like, I'm really on this movie's wavelength, and I can't wait
Yeah,
for.
because like maybe it's like maybe the harpoon could happen. Like
Yeah.
maybe that could happen. The
Right.
hibachi could never happen. Like it's, there's no the distance, the sort of like if you get the tape measures out and stuff and like you do the thing physics wise, the one of the precepts around designing the deaths in the movie was that they were all impossible, right? And because they were impossible, I was going to maintain this comic remove, and it was going to li live in the land of the absurd fact that we die, right? That none of it was actually like threatening to anybody, and no one could stand up and say, "Hey, wait a minute! I was traumatized like that when I was a kid because Aunt Shirley re that really happened to her. She ate 5,000 hornets, and it was terrible,
Yeah.
sad." So it was sort of like that. It was like grief proof, You know what I mean?
Yes.
This movie, everything was like, no, that never happened to anybody, so I'm safe.
It's so funny. Yeah, 5,000 hornets killed my paw, and
Yeah,
like, you
right.
know,
And how dare you, sir?
it's
Right?
like
Yeah.
the joke at the end of The Naked Gun where Ricardo Montalban gets run over by the steamroller and then trampled on by a marching band, and then
Exactly.
George Kennedy goes, "It's terrible, Frank. My father went the same way."
It's exactly that.
The
Quite a
you
series
know
of
I,
things.
that harpoon at the beginning too is, you're right, maybe there is a circumstance where
Maybe.
you accidentally get shot by a harpoon, but then the harpoon retracts and it
That's
takes it to a,
the
you
real
know
problem. Yeah.
I love that you keep hitting high notes like the Mariah Carey of kill scenes, like just
Well, it's this sort of
building.
moment, this sort of like this like suspended moment of like, oh, he's gonna be okay. Like it's fine. Like the thing, it went through, it didn't hit any vital organs. It just went through him. It's gonna be fine. Like you hear about those things, right? Like, oh, I got impaled, but it missed everything. So they just kind of took me off the thing and put me back in, and I walked off. But yeah, the retracting becomes a problem.
That's like Groundhog Day when they go off the cliff and crash, the truck flips upside down, and Chris Elliott goes, "Well, you might be okay," and then it explodes in a fireball, and he goes, "Yeah, probably not now."
Probably not now, Chris Elliott.
So this chat's going to come out after the movie. I still don't want to spoil anything in case anybody's listening who hasn't seen it at this point. But I do want to say that you also have a cherry on top, an exclamation point to end the movie. So how important is it for you for that final frame of your films? Is that something that you think about like well in advance and build towards? Or is, you know, maybe this feels like a variation of my tone question and I might be getting the exact same answer, but like how important is the first shot and the last shot of a movie for you?
I'm very good at beginnings and I'm very bad at endings. And what usually ends up happening is we kind of have to discover the end kind of as we go. And I know that's not like the most kind of like bold admission that a storyteller can tell. And I always wish that I was like, I wrote the ending first. And then I reverse engineered a movie or a story to kind of justify this great ending. What ends up happening for me is it's like wading out into the ocean a little bit, right? It's like, oh, I've got this really good feeling. I want to get wet. It's hot out and I want to be in the water and I want to go into this thing and I want to see how that feels and I want to be part of this thing. And so, you know, I always feel this like big surge at the beginning of a project or at the beginning of a movie or at the beginning of a story that I'm telling, where it's like there's a lot of energy and I do have a hard time sort of finding where it ends. You know, and so in the case of Long Legs, like we had a bit of a longer ending with the doll that ended up feeling very false. We shot it, we looked at it, we sort of tried different variations on it, ultimately landed on the kind of what it was, which was the right thing. But it was the result of me and my collaborators, because I'm not doing any of this alone, thank God. Thank God I've got really great editors. Thank God I've got really great producers. Thank God I've got really great friends. And thank God you show these things to audiences. And you know, sometimes there's a lot of defensiveness in the industry around kind of like, oh, we didn't need reshoots. How dare you? Like we got it all right the first time. And I'm always a little bit like, what's the big deal? Like we're trying to make something for the people. It's not an exercise in perfection. It's you're trying to serve up an experience. And if a test audience or an audience of friends and family say, didn't quite reach me, then guess what? I'm wrong. They're right. I'm wrong. There's no version of, oh, the audience is stupid. The audience isn't stupid. The audience is super smart. And the audience knows what they feel. And if you miss it, you miss it. And in the case of the monkey, you know, we had the proper ending is sort of sweet. It sort of had the kind of resolved with the father son in the car, and it had the pale rider. Like it still had that kind of like last kind of flourish of surreality. But then it kind of was ended sweetly, and we kind of got there. And if I say we, I mean me and my team. We kind of got to the end, and we're like, well, we should. You know what? People are going to want one last bite. Like they just want one last kicker to send them out into the night. Because what I ultimately want, I think, for people to feel when they walk out of this movie is I want them to like touch their own limbs and be like, all right, everything's still good, right? Everything's still attached. Now I get to go have sushi or have sex or smoke a joint or go to sleep, or I get to go kiss my kids or whatever it is I get to do now after I've just seen all of this insane carnage. I'm still whole. And so it made sense to kind of ruin like a bunch of lives right at the end of the movie, like in a really grotesque and just like rude way, right? Just like a really kind of appallingly rude way, because that the juxtaposition is you walk out of the theater with all your limbs attached and you say, how lucky am I?
I love that Oz too, because it's sort of like, is it over now? Oh, no.
Well, and
It's like
de
no,
death isn't over, right? I mean, that's the
no,
thing, is like,
it never ends.
yeah.
And you know, you can drive off into the sunset, you can get the green light because the light turns from red to green. It's like, oh, everything's fine. They drive off into the sunset, they're still whole, but this poor busload of people is not.
Well, you have the mother running. This is in the trailer too. So the mother running with the bassinet that's on fire, pushing a little like that could be really bad taste, but it's played so funny, and you don't see a burning baby. It's just this sort of mom. So it's almost like a Far Side cartoon in some way.
It is, and I said to the stunt performer who did it, because you have to have a stunt performer do that because they're basically just eating smoke, right? They're just like, you have to get a professional person in there to do that. You can't get an actor to come and push a flaming baby carriage. That has to be someone who doesn't mind fire in their face. And the only thing I said to her was take a big deep breath and scream the whole way. One long continuous pitchy scream. And I don't think we had to doctor it in post. I think we actually just used her lav mic. And I was like, as long as you're screaming one continuous scream the whole way, it's funny. If you're crying or asking for help or something, it's probably not funny. It's probably a little bit too much. But if you give it one good kind of Chuck Jones, Roadrunner kind of peel all the way across, it's probably funny and it works pretty well.
And it does.
That's what works, is there's no suffering in this movie,
There's
right?
no
Nobody's.
suffering. Nobody suffers, right? And there's plenty of horror pictures where people suffer, and I find those hard. I don't go to them. I don't rewatch them. I try to avoid them. So real suffering is not, I'm not interested. Like, and when I get approached with like true crime, same thing. Like, I'll never do a true crime piece. I would never do anything like that because I'm not interested in real suffering. That's private. That's someone else's business. Like, and I know that it's fetishized, and I know that Netflix kind of makes a big meal out of it, and that like that's its thing, and that's what it is. But it strikes me as kind of in poor taste, I almost want to say, because it's like there's nothing cool about it. There's nothing cool about the fact that people actually suffered in these situations. And so to kind of recreate suffering seems like, I don't know. There's so many other things you can do in your day. Do you know? I don't know. I'm not trying to, proselytize or anything. I just, for me, it's
I
like
agree.
just for everybody out there who knows not to bring me like, oh, this really happened. It was this family, they got murdered in their house. I'm like, no. I can pretend that's fine because then it's just theater, right? Then it's just sort of like, then it's just show. But as soon as it really happened to someone, the energy off of that really stinks to me.
Was there an experimental thing that happened during the making of this where you would say like, actually, this death is, we've got to do something else different because it's too
No,
real or too.
by the time by the time the script was finished, like I said, everything was sort of so hokey, like not hokey, but just so kind of like insane and just like so like can't ever happen. There's no ballistics people that can come in and be like, yep, that surely could have happened that way. Once I knew I was clear of that, I felt pretty safe. And then there was opportunity to sort of add on to that. So it's like the guy under the lawnmower just spraying blood. It's like, well, that's gruesome and all, but what if like, oh, what if it's like Home Improvement and his neighbor's watching from the other side of the fence and he's just getting splattered with blood, and he doesn't really care because it's his fucking neighbor who he hates, right? Like, oh, about time that fucker with his lawnmower that I always wanted is now dead.
Did you ever, was it a much of an exercise while you were writing to come up with these deaths? Because in the short story, there is this a babysitter who gets killed, so you've got that touch point, but you give her a different ending. Like, was there a way that you spurred your imagination to really think of the kind of Tom and Jerry, itchy and scratchy, Wile E. Coyote way of taking somebody out?
The I mean the first one that I wrote, because the harpoon was kind of moved from a different place, and I kind of refashioned it for this cold open and kind of did that. The first death that I knew that was going to be a thing was the Benihana death, and it just grew out of my experience, and not to say that it's ever happened, but my experience was that I would take my kids always wanted to go to Benihana for their birthdays. Like, that's just what we did. And then there used to be the Benihana in La Cienega, and now that's gone. Now there's only the Benihana in Tarzana. You got to go out to Tarzana. You got to go out to fucking thing to get to Benihana. And so Benihana was just sort of part of my growing up, my children's growing up. So I put a scene in there. Do you know what I mean? And so it's like, where would I put my kids? I put them in Benihana. Oh, well, there's fire. It's probably not fire. Probably the person doesn't get sizzled to death. Oh, they probably get cut somehow. Oh, I guess it's just a beheading, because that couldn't really ever happen. And I guess it's just like that. So you just, like anybody who creates anything, you, like I said before, you kind of just got to let it go and let it flow. And in this case, I positioned it in a place that was true for me. Kids love Benihana. That was just like a true fact. Kids love Benihana. Love Benihana. So stick it in Benihana and see what happens. And then you get in there with your characters, and you kind of ask the situation in a way. You kind of try to conjure the thing, and out comes he cuts her head off.
Yes, and then the head falls on the grill and sizzles for a
And
bit.
then the head falls into the fried rice, which is my favorite dish at Benihana.
Well, there you
It's
go.
all about me, guys. I'm trying to tell you.
No, it's
It's
fine.
autobiographical,
Now, I saw the live stream screening that you did. I was at the Alamo here in Austin watching. And you, I believe you mentioned during that live stream that for you, the monkey is God, right? And that kind of this purveyor, like you, unknowable but determiner of life and death. Do you, as the author of this piece, of this adaptation, do you have an idea of what this monkey wants, what this god thing wants, or are you literally just there going, the randomness is the point?
I think it was just that, again, just to kind of retreat to my own experience, was like in developing the material and kind of digging into it and being in this place of like, oh, well, I had the most insane possible death happen to me with my mom. There was no monkey around. I didn't turn a key to make that happen. So there's this feeling of like, it's gonna happen. It is gonna happen, monkey or no monkey, right? Like the sort of like the game of living, I suppose, is just to accept your monkey. You just to take your monkey with you. Like that's where Hal ends up at the end of the movie, right? It's like, and we keep it. We hold it close. Implicit in that is, and you don't turn the key, but that doesn't matter. As we see, they drive off into the sunset and 10 people die. Nobody turns the key, right? It has nothing to do with the monkey. The death is present. The pale rider is afoot. And so there was just that it just as the priest says, it is what it is, right? We die, some of us peacefully in our sleep, as the mom says, some of us horribly tied up with clothesline and screaming through duct tape over our mouths and all that jazz, right? It's like, that's just I there's nothing so profound. It's honestly like the thing I love the most about it is that there's really nothing so profound about it. It's really the simplest, most elemental thing to say, that everybody dies and that's life. And when that kind of little piece of poetry, which was I felt very pithy, just sort of came to me one day at the coffee shop, just doing my thing. I was like, oh, everybody dies and that's life, right? So you see how that happens. It just happens. And it's a simple truth, and it turns out to be the poster sentiment. Sometimes the ball goes in, sometimes the ball goes out, guys. Do you know what I mean? Like sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not. It's not so deep to say any of that. But I think that the element of kind of like we surrender to the fact that we're not in control. Sometimes a day is good, sometimes a day is bad. It's sort of freeing and energizing, I think, in a way, as opposed to kind of wasting your time and energy trying to evade it or deny it. I think that becomes hard.
Well, and the more you try to exert that control, that's when things get really fucked up for our characters.
It's exhausting, right?
And the more you try to exert control, the more wrong things get, and like the angrier you make the monkey god. And then
when he tries to make it hit the drum and it doesn't want to hit the drum, it crashes a plane and it blows up a town.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, you can't do that. You can't make me.
The scary, that's what I think is the scary part of this horror comedy is the, you know, we've talked about the funny parts, but the scary part is it's not that God has a desire. If the monkey is God, it's there's an indifference to whatever, if there is some sort of sentience out there, like it just, you don't matter. You're not Job, like deliberately being tormented. It's the indifference to you that is chilling, right? That
yeah. And it's
implacable.
And you can have sort of two relationships with it doesn't matter. You can be like, oh, it doesn't matter. Or you can be, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Right? It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And I think that maybe the privilege that comes out of having experienced tragedy and loss is that you can maybe find your way to it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Which is probably better than, oh my God, nothing matters. Oh my God, nothing matters. It's sort of a choice to make. And I think that the thrust of the monkey tonally and comedically is supposed to land us in the place of, guys, it doesn't matter. And that's fine.
Oz, I know Stephen King takes a kind of hands-off approach to adaptation. You'll run casting by him or something is sort of the typical way it goes. Was there anything unusual about your collaboration with him? Or I know you just recently did like a joint interview with him, right?
What was unusual about it was that he didn't ever try to stop me on anything. He never noted me. He never gave me feedback. He never pushed back. There was never any resistance. There was never any commentary. He gave us sort of quiet, tacit approval through Rand, his guy, who's his only rep in the world. Everything passes through Rand Holston. Mm-hmm. And so, who's, by the way, just a lovely dude all around. And so I just kept getting the kind of silent salute. And I felt sort of like, all right, well, this is going well. And then, as we said, finally, you know, meeting the guy, and just having his kind of, he was so deferential, right? He was like, you did it. Like, what do you like? He didn't take any ownership for the monkey. There was nothing about King in our meeting that was like, hey, thanks for doing that for me, mm-hmm. or like, you did good by me, kid, or any of that stuff. It was like, wow, what an insane thing you did! I love it so much. Like, it's so lovable. Well done. I love it. It was great. It was really great.
Now that you've taken a bite out of the Stephen King apple, do you want to go back? Would there be any other Stephen King thing that you might want to take a stab at?
I think the fun, the kind of the real win of where I'm at currently is that I think I've established the rule now, which is that everything I do is one of one. Mm. Nothing is going to be, we're not going to retread anything. So it's like, will there be a Long Legs 2? I don't supposed to be like everybody wants her to be like it's out there, right? Like, would it be like Long Legs 1? Man, you better believe that whatever a Long Legs 2 will have nothing to fucking do with Long Legs 1. Like, how could it have anything to do with Long Legs 1? So in terms of like what kind of is ahead or what comes next, I think the game that I'm engaged in, I'm so fortunate to have the opportunity, is to do something really different every time. And so if there was going to be another King thing, God, I honestly can't imagine. It feels so complete. Do you know what I mean? It feels like such like a move that we made. We landed the plane, as it were, and people really dig it. And don't fuck with it. You know, like don't put your head in the tiger's mouth again. We tried something very kind of chancy, because I think everybody knows as soon as you say the words horror comedy together to people with money in the business, they say, oh, I think not. I'd rather not. Thank you very much for offering, but no. So we already kind of got, we took that chance. We succeeded. And I think I might just let it sit.
No, that's very fair. But also, to be fair, King has a breadth of material out there. You could make something by him that has absolutely nothing to do tonally with this thing. All I'm saying is, you done, when people who adapt King well once, they almost always adapt him well again. We're looking at the Frank Darabonts, the Rob Reiners of this world,
Mike
Mike
Flanagan.
Flanagan. Yeah. So all I'm saying is that history has been kind to those who have knocked a Stephen King adaptation out of the park and coming back. So
Oz,
true.
you also did I wanted to bring up a Stephen King adjacent writer, friend of Steve's, is Paul Tremblay, and I didn't realize. I know this was public, but I guess I had just forgotten it, that you had done an adaptation of Head Full of Ghosts. I don't
Yeah.
think we're getting that movie. Is there
I
anything
don't
you
think
can
we're getting
share?
that movie. We it was a great experience for me. The producers, it was Susan Downey and Robert Downey Jr. controlled the material. And then it was their producing partners who I wrote the script with. And it was the project on which I really learned how great notes are. How great if you've got producers or collaborators who are giving informed notes. I think there's this thing where people are like, I don't want any notes. Don't tell me what to do. Don't criticize my thing. Don't have idea. I don't need your ideas. I got this. And it's such a myopic way of doing anything. The notes process on that developing that script was so great, and they were so smart about everything they did. They taught me so much about it. It was a great, 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 great script. I really was so proud of it. And it's just, it's like these, you hear about these, like these baby turtles that try to cross the street in Florida and they all get killed. That's making movies, right? That's trying to get a movie made. It's like a little baby turtle trying to get across the fucking highway. And they don't happen. And for whatever reason, it just never happened. But love that script. Love that book. What a cool thing that was. And it was just like this like tweaky possession movie that was sort of like, is she possessed or is she just a teenager?
Yeah,
Right.
exactly. That's the one King read, and I think he tweeted about it and helped kind
Yeah,
of
it was
make
great.
that book. So,
Yeah, it was great. It was
yeah,
great.
Paul's been on the show. He's a friend of the show.
Yeah, Paul's a good dude.
And now you are a friend of the show, Oz. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, and I hope we can lure you back again. Maybe we can dive into that Pet Sematary trauma a little bit.
My pleasure. Tell your friends to see the picture. Tell them to take their 13, 14, 15-year-olds. I really think I actually made a kids movie, and like in a weird, disturbed kind of way. But take your family, take your friends.
Bring a little, I think King, wasn't there something where King said, bring a little kid you don't like.
Many thanks to Osgood Perkins for answering all our pressing nerdy questions about the movie. And thanks once again to Neon and Atomic Monster for sponsoring the show these last few weeks. The next episode up is scheduled to drop March 12th. And should everything stay on schedule, it'll be with a pair of KingCast newbies who have a really cool looking film coming out very soon. I'll keep their names under my hat for right now, just in case there's some scheduling conflicts that pop up. But their chosen title is Eyes of the Dragon, which is a very fun title to talk about. It's an early Stephen King fantasy story. It is yet to be adapted into a film or TV series, and it's got direct ties to the Dark Tower. I love talking about this title. So read up on it if you need a refresher. You got a couple of weeks. In the meantime, you can check out the show's Patreon, which is at patreon.com/thekingcast, where you'll get extra bonus episodes that you can find only there. If you're new to the show, you'll have over 4 years of bonus episodes banked. You got super fun guests, you got commentaries, you got plenty of stuff to peruse through. It's the best way to support the show. So if you dig it, throw us a few bucks and we'll make it worth your while. That's patreon.com/thekingcast. Until next time, adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.